with the uncertainty, trying to think about what can I control and what can't I control? And control the things we can, but then try to, you know, maybe plan for the things we can't control, but not get stuck in a rut ruminating on them.
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is Jen Heemstra. I work on the chemistry of nucleic acids in the Department of Chemistry at Emory University, and I am enthusiastic to share my tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Jennifer Heemstra received her undergraduate degree in chemistry at the University of California, Irvine, where she developed a love of supramolecular chemistry. She did her PhD at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, with Jeffrey Moore. And then after a brief stint in industry as a medicinal chemist, she moved to Harvard University for a postdoc with David Liu, exploring mechanisms for templated nucleic acid synthesis. In 2010, Jen set up her own lab in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Utah. And in 2017, she moved to Emory University, where she was promoted to full professor last year, 2021. Research in her lab is focused on harnessing the molecular recognition and self-assembly properties of nucleic acids for applications in biosensing and bioimaging. Her blog, Things That Change the Way I Think, is full of career advice for scientists, and she had a regular column, Office Hours, in Chemical and Engineering News, I think, until last year. She often encourages students to embrace failure in order to succeed, and she's been described as one of the most influential scientists on social media. Jen, thanks for coming to share your tips with the Lonely Pipette.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here and get to talk with you.
So we're really excited that you accepted to be a guest, particularly because you're our first branch outsider of the life sciences community. So I know you work on nucleic acids, but you really come from chemistry. So that's great. This is the first time that the Lonely Pipette is talking to a chemist. So,
well, that's fun. And it's funny because I have not, now we work on biomolecules, but I have not always done that. And so our lab now, we run tons of gels and PCRs and do lots of things with pipetters. But the story I love to tell my group is about how much, when we talk about being able to branch into new areas of research, I love to share about how different what our lab does now is from what I did in my PhD, which was all organic chemistry. And one of the examples I use is, well, I used pipetters a lot, but we did something that would horrify all of you, which is that we use them only for organic solvents. And then I get the look of horror on everyone's face, and we all laugh about it. And so I thought that was especially relevant given the title of your podcast.
So that's perfect. Probably, I don't know if this is the one reason you accepted to come to talk with us today, but for sure, we are super happy that you're here with us today. So you may not be used to our podcast. You may not have listened to some episode, but we have a special question to start with. We call it a bit the superhero question, or I don't know, the origin story. We want to know how you decided to become a scientist.
Well, how I became a scientist and how I became a chemist are a little bit different. So I can talk about how I became a chemist later, but how I became a scientist is actually because maybe not completely because, but kind of, it was a series of events that was set off by my eighth grade science teacher saying that I was bad at science. And the way that this manifested itself is that when I was about to start in ninth grade, this is where in the US you bridge from junior high up to high school, or at least where I lived. And I had to wait in a line for my guidance counselor to pull a little, this was like the 90s, pull a little 3x5 card out of a box and tell me whether or not my eighth grade science teacher had said that I was good enough at science to be able to take biology in the ninth grade. Because if you were good at science, you could take biology in ninth grade, then do all of the advanced courses. And if you were quote unquote not good at science, then they sent you off to take some other elective and you went into this more, you know, remedial, minimal track of science classes. And I saw all my friends coming back in line after they'd been to the front and saying, oh, yes, I'm taking biology. Yes, I'm taking biology. And I thought, well, I was really good at math and I knew that. I thought, well, I thought I was really good at science. So awesome. Can't wait to take biology with you all. And I got to the front of the line and my guidance counselor pulled out my card and she said, you are not approved to take biology. And I just like that shock of like, well, wait, certainly you must have the wrong card. No, your eighth grade science teacher said that you were not skilled at science. So let's talk about what else you might want to take instead. And so that was a big moment for me. I mean, thankfully, I had not really built an identity as like, I want to be a scientist, but it was still really disappointing. So I went and took typing instead, which actually, as a faculty member, is probably one of the most useful classes I could have possibly taken because I probably type tens of thousands of words every day. I feel like I need a tracker just to find out what that actual number is, and 80% of them in the form of emails, sadly. But what ended up happening is that I was taking this typing class, but all my friends who were in biology, a lot of them had joined this group called Science Olympiad, which is this after-school club where you study different topics and then you go and you do this competition against other teams from other schools. And I wanted something to do after school so that I wouldn't go home. And they said, oh, you should do Science Olympiad. And I said, well, I'm not good at science, right? I'm not even taking biology. And they said, no, the coach is just really, really cool. Show up. She's amazing. Just come. You can just even hang out there if you don't want to do Science Olympiad. So I said, sure, that sounds great. And I showed up. The coach, Dr. Marcia Sprang, said, welcome to Science Olympiad. And I was like, I'm not good at science, not in biology. She said, that's okay. We have this geology event where you study rocks and nobody takes geology. So you are no better or worse off than anyone else. Go have fun. And I dove into it and I realized that I just absolutely loved it. And eventually she, you know, partway through the year, once she realized how much I loved science and how much I was just, you know, doing to study on my own for Science Olympiad, she said, well, wait, why are you not taking biology? And I said, oh, I wasn't approved to, I wasn't allowed to. And she gave like the hugest eye roll ever. It was like, oh, that's ridiculous. We're going to fix this. And we worked out a way that I could kind of double up some of my classes and still get to take all the advanced classes. But the more important thing is that I don't know if I would have loved science as much if I'd been told I was really good at it. If I was told I was really good at it, I would have been like, oh no, people are expecting me to do well. This is something I have to do. I should do Science Olympiad. But it was an opportunity, one of those rare opportunities to go and do something where no one was expecting much of me.
Yeah.
But then I discovered that I really, really loved it at the same time. So that kind of high amount of passion for what I was doing, but also low external expectations. And given my personality type, that was like the perfect fertile soil for me to fall in love with science and decide I wanted to become a scientist.
Do you still have that, that when someone says no, that makes you more motivated?
You go there.
Oh, heck
like,
yeah.
Like grants, yeah. Or editors or...
Yes. Oh, yeah. If someone wants me to do something, they should probably tell me you can't do it. To which then my group members, of course, think up all sorts of creative things they want to tell me I can't do. But I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way. Actually, we were out on a rock climbing outing once with my lab because I'm a rock climber. And we were coming back up at the end of the day. And there's this one climb that looked kind of fun. The people who had just climbed it, they said, oh, yeah, this one's kind of fun, but you have to have what's called a stick clip where, you know, you go up and you clip the first first carabiner with your rope ahead of time because the bottom was really, really kind of slick and supposedly dangerous. And they're like, oh, yeah, but you're not going to be able to do it without a stick clip and we're leaving and you don't have one, so you can't do it. And so I looked at it and I was like, well, that don't look so bad. We've got some crash pads because we've been bouldering. I was like, let's put down the crash pads. And I went right up and I did it and I clipped the draw. I was like, you don't need a stick clip. And apparently my group members told me later who were there, they said, oh yeah, you should have seen your face when those other climbers said, you can't do this. They're like, we all looked at each other and we're like, oh, this is happening now, isn't it? So I was like, wow, you all know me so well. Am I that transparent? Yes. Yes, you are.
So that's perfect. We start with a beautiful secret from how to make you go in a way or not. But
yeah, and I was going to say, you said you wanted me to share something I've never shared on podcast. I think you've already gotten me to share two things.
Yes.
that I have pipetted organic solvents with pipetters. So I'm now going to be shunned by any self-respecting molecular biologist. And also that rock climbing story. Mm-hmm.
So if someone told you were good in science and you decided that you were not going to do science, what would you have become, do you think?
That's a wonderful question. You know, I don't know, rewinding back to high school, given what was in front of me right then, I probably would have gone into something based on math because I did still love math. Actually, within mm-hmm. chemistry, one of my favorite courses ever was quantum, which is this very math heavy course. And it's so far from what my lab does now. But it was because it was just all of this beautiful math and you didn't have to think about some sort of physical reality behind it. You could just enjoy all of the math. So in high school, I probably would have gone into math or engineering. But now at this point in my career, with the different opportunities I've had, thinking, well, what other thing could I have been really happy doing? One of the things near the top of the list is actually architecture, mm-hmm. because it's a lot of that same problem solving and design and working with other people. All of those things that I love about my job now really also play into at least some architecture job. So I've had the opportunity to be on a few building design committees now through universities I've worked at, and the architects that we work with on those building design committees, I look at what they do and think, oh, that would be really, really fun. Some of the really detailed stuff I would not enjoy, but a lot of the big design thinking and problem solving and working with other people, think, oh, I could be happy doing that.
So you talk a lot about the doubts that scientists have. Are there times when you considered leaving science or leaving chemistry?
Well, I will say that I actually spent all of graduate school thinking, it isn't so much that I thought about leaving, it's the academic path. It's that I thought I could never even be on that academic path. And so when I was an undergraduate working in a lab, all I knew is that, wow, this is this thing I really enjoy doing, coming in and doing research and problem solving and working with my hands and setting up reactions and like, oh, the fun when you run a column and rotovap down the solution and it's this beautiful bright yellow crystalline solid and you get an NMR and the baseline is perfect. And you know, of course, that only happens like 5% of the time. It's like having, I play golf too. So it's like having your perfect golf round or having that perfect hole where you get a birdie. You know, it's only every once in a while, but it's enough joy that it's kind of addictive. It's that dopamine rush that keeps you coming back through all the failures. I knew I loved that, but I thought I could never go to grad school. So when people started talking to me about grad school, I said, oh goodness, I would never get in. And if I did, I would never make it through. And thankfully, people said, my undergraduate research advisor and the graduate students.
People said to you, you cannot go to graduate school. And you said, okay, I'm going to go.
Well, they told me a few things I could not go to do in graduate school. They heavily vetted my choices of advisors and research areas. And that I actually listened carefully to and was very glad that I did. But no, actually, in that case, I did need someone to say, no, you should really do this. And so I went to graduate school and had a blast. But the entire time, you know, all through that, I knew that my dream job was what I'm doing now, to be a faculty member at a research university. But I always looked at what my own advisors did and just thought, there is no way that I could possibly do that. So between that and then also just some kind of expectations in the faith tradition that I was brought up in about what women's roles should be and whether or not, you know, you should work outside of the home even or have this more ambitious career. I just thought between all of those things mixed together, this career path was absolutely, completely unattainable. And it took a lot of different, some of them quite traumatic events actually to really shatter my worldview first to make me think that this was something that I could have. And then it took a lot of really phenomenal advice and support from my mentors to help me think that it could even be possible. But then after going through all of that and ending up in this job that I always, always wanted, it's a little bit, you know, adversity in some ways, it's like a slingshot sometimes, that it stretches you and stretches you and stretches you. And it's so painful. And sometimes, tragically, you just stretch to the point that the slingshot breaks, especially if you don't have the right support network around you. But in cases where adversity stretches you and stretches you, and you still have the support that you need in order to not break, then when that adversity is released, it's like you're like the stone coming out of the slingshot, and you come out of it with way more energy and drive and focus than even before, feeling empowered, feeling fearless. So some of the things I've gone through, when I've thankfully been very fortunate and had the privilege to have phenomenal mentors and a phenomenal support network around me who helped me get through those things. And then as I've come out of those, you just feel so fearless and empowered.
Yeah, solid.
And focused. And so I think, you know, for 10 years thinking that this career path was unattainable and trying to think, what else do I want to do? Well, what else do I want to do? Well, I can't have this. So what else do I want to do? And then finally, somehow actually landing the job, actually through a very stressful job hunt, and for a while thinking I wouldn't have a job, and then getting actually the job of my dreams. It was like, all right, I never thought I could be here. I'm probably going to have to work harder than I've ever worked just to be average, or just to even have some minuscule shot at getting tenure, because I'm starting out behind of everyone. But whatever, I'm just going to go for it.
So you give a lot of credit to your mentors. I know you speak with a lot of respect of the mentors that you've had. What are the mentoring practices that you use in your own lab that you learned from your mentors?
I would say that one of the really important things that, well, actually, maybe the most important thing that I've had to learn about being a mentor is that the sorts of mentoring that I wanted or needed and still need are not always the types of mentoring that every person in my research lab wants or needs.
Can you be more specific about that?
Yeah. Well, one example is that I am someone who already puts a lot of pressure on myself. I'm very driven by trying to get things done very, very quickly and efficiently and trying to maximize productivity. Actually, just learned in the business world, there's this thing called Six Sigma, and it's all about process and optimizing process. And I heard someone talking to me about this. I was like, you have just explained how my brain works. So you're telling me not all people think like that? I always thought, you know, I'm someone, you give me a list of errands and I'm already planning out, well, how can I put these in order so that as I drive, I only have to make the right turns and I avoid all the stoplights. And when I do go to the grocery store, how can I move through the aisles as efficiently, as quickly as possible? And I'm going to keep an eye on all of the lanes in order to make sure I end up in the one that has the fewest people. And I'll be calculating in the back of my head as we go. I was like, wait, not everyone.
I am
like
not
that.
Like that. No, I'm the complete opposite of that.
My spouse is as well. I get the list. I'm like, so what order are we going to go in? So can Max? And he's like, I don't know. I don't care. Do whatever you want to do.
Did you have experiences that you realized that the people in your lab were maybe not like that and maybe needed something very different? And how did you adapt? How do you adapt to different needs?
You know, honestly, it was just people in the lab telling me. It was once people got up the courage
Jen, calm
to
down.
Say, well, no, it was more that, so I'm like that. And so my PhD advisor, I think, saw that in me. And also, I am fiercely independent. You know, I crave autonomy. Like, I want to know I have help when I need it. Like, I have the phone a friend when I need it. But mostly, I just want, you know, it's like, no, let me try it first. Let me try it first. Don't show me how to do this. I want to try it first. And I've probably been like that since I was about 2 years old. I think my mom would tell you. And I think my advisor saw that and realized, and I came into, actually, because of how I found my major in undergraduate and decided to do things, I came into graduate school with a privilege of having much more research experience than was probably typical at the time. So for me, my graduate experience was to come in and arrange with my PhD advisor, like, okay, you're going to give me a project. And then I think we just both tacitly agreed, I got this. Just let me run with it. Let me do my own thing. Let me kind of operate as this little mini PI within your lab. And as long as the funding is coming in and, you know, thank you for the funding and I can buy supplies and I will let you know when I need stuff. And that was so perfect. And that was exactly what I wanted. And I had a phenomenal mentor who knew how to give me that space and still be there to support me. And because that was so much fun and so motivating for me, I assumed certainly everyone in my lab, this is what we'll have in our lab. We'll, you know, just give people tons of autonomy and everyone will have a blast and it'll be great. And that certainly worked well for some people. But then other people finally said, you know, some more guidance would actually be good. Or some people have just come to me and said, you know, when I have a deadline, when I'm working on a manuscript, it's really helpful if you check in with me every week and say, did you accomplish your goals on writing this week? Did you achieve their goals? So like, I want that accountability. I work better when I have that accountability. And I'm thinking in my head, like, what you're describing is my worst nightmare. I would be miserable working under those conditions. But if that's what works for you, let's do that. Yeah.
Did you respond well? Did you hear that cry for a different type of mentoring?
I did. Actually, because I had already seen it in a smaller way. Probably there's all of these different dimensions, right, to our personalities, you know, infinite number of dimensions. And one of the ones that you see really quickly, I think, as a mentor or lab supervisor is just realizing that dial of the amount of kind of pressure or motivation that people want. You know, some people are driving themselves so hard already. You know, your job is to just pull that pressure off, to say, like, don't worry about it. Miss that deadline. Okay. Go home. Relax. Go home. But then again, other people want that. Oh, I want, if I'm not in by this time in the morning, I want you to send me an email and be like, where were you? Because I want to know that I have that accountability. So I think I saw that pretty early on, that I saw, oh, my job as an advisor is that there's this really nice middle amount of pressure where it's enough to motivate you, but it's not harming you. It makes the work fun. It gets you into that zone. And my job is to adjust and be kind of the dial that helps each person hit that middle road. Yeah. So I had started to realize that. And so then once people started saying, no, we want to have more meetings with you where we have to show our goals and show our progress, I think I was really open to it by then, because I had started to realize, and I had actually started to ask, like, what would help everyone achieve their goals? What would help you achieve your goals? What could I do to help you be your best?
That's so great, this vision of keeping this balance between taking out the pressure and putting a bit more of pressure in the system. So now there is also something that we really love to hear. Is what do you consider as bad mentoring advice that you had heard or you had from others?
I would say that maybe some bad advice I got. I think often the bad advice is when someone is trying. I'm sure I've given lots of, as I'm saying this, I'm realizing I have given tons of bad mentoring advice in exactly the format I'm about to say. And that is telling someone else, you know, here, do this thing, but really it's something that's worked for me, not necessarily something that's going to work for them. That we're reflecting our own personalities and preferences and perspectives on the world in the advice that we give to someone else. Actually, an example of advice that was kind of the same advice, but in a really not great way and in a really great way that I received, is that early in my career, I also have a very short attention span. And I like to do lots of things. And that's partly my personality, but it's also partly because for so long, I thought I could never have this job. You know, I thought I couldn't do any of the things. Mm-hmm. And now that I have it, I'm like, I want to do all of the things now, right? but you also have to get tenure. And so early in my career, I think some of my more senior colleagues recognized that I was on this path. I was getting involved in all of these things, and that while that was great, maybe some of them thought it was great and some didn't, but that this could potentially interfere with me getting the things done that I needed in order to get tenure. And mm-hmm. I think the really unhelpful way that came out is someone told me, you just need to focus. You need to do less things. You need to get rid of some of these things. You need to choose one research area, or you need to do less on the education side or on the service side. You know, this is just what you need to do. Whereas, because then that's just like, well, no, do you think I think I actually looked at them and said, do you think I don't have the energy it takes to do all of that and do what I need to get tenure? I probably said it nicer than that, but I essentially said that. And then I think they probably never gave me advice again, which is probably my loss. But then one of my other colleagues, I think this was the really, really helpful way that they came and told me this, is to say, hey, I see all of these things you're doing. And I actually think that's outstanding. What you're doing is really great. However, you also need to realize that, you know, all of these things over here are probably not going to necessarily, they're really cool, but they're probably not going to help you for tenure, or they're not going to make up for shortfalls in these other areas. And so it's great you want to do all of this, but I want you to get tenure and keep being here and being my colleague. So just make sure it's not getting in the way of all of these other things that are really, really essential. And that was perfect because they just laid out the situation for me, but then still gave me the freedom to choose what I wanted to do. Because it turns out, right, I'm a big intrinsic motivation person. So if you let me have that extra 5 to 10 hours a week, that's stuff I don't have to do, but just 100% because I want to do it, then that helps me be even more focused and even more productive in the things that I have to do.
For what I understand, it looks like it's not about the numbers of stuff you're doing inside, outside, or whatever. It's maybe about more having this capacity of prioritizing depending when you are at your stage. I mean, doing prioritization, probably is not something that is always like one face, but it can evolve through time. And so you can keep all what you like to do. It's just that sometimes you push more on one side without losing the other one. And sometimes you can inverse.
Yeah, you heard it when you said you get a list and the first thing you do is you're putting them in order, right?
Yeah.
I think the only thing I'm good at is when I get a list is deciding which things are at the bottom.
And I'm quite good at that too.
Those are the things I'm not going to do today. But I think a lot of academics find it hard to, you know, we're asked to do so many things. It's very hard to work out where your priorities are.
Yeah, the prioritization is difficult. And I think, as Reno said, it's always changing as well. I don't know how much you all feel this, but you seem like change makers in academia or people who are innovating in the ways that you're thinking about doing things. The fact that you're doing this podcast shows that you are innovating and putting time into things that you think are meaningful, but are not things that people in your roles traditionally do. And from that perspective, something I found, and I'm curious if you feel this too, is that there's always this sense of, how do I do enough of this traditional stuff that I'm supposed to do, or do my job enough the way that I am quote unquote supposed to do it in order to be successful within this system and structure as it exists right now, but then do enough stuff differently or additionally that is not part of that system and structure, might not be valued by it or might even be opposed by it, but that's really personally meaningful to me and might be also contributing to hopefully changing that system and structure for the next generation of researchers. I don't know. Do you feel that as well?
All the time. But I do think that it probably, a lot of it depends on where you are in your career. So you now have tenure at a major university. So this gives you a massive luxury to be able to make a lot of choices, and maybe you'll invest differently. I'm in the French system. There's a lot of pressure to do a lot of things at the same time, but they're not all given the same value when it comes to promotion, getting money, etc. So it's very complicated.
Yeah. I was just going to say, yeah, that's your point about tenure. That's exactly what I was saying. It's like my colleague's advice to me was like, okay, within this tenure time, like, you need to really focus on kind of work, you know, do your other stuff, but really work in the system, and so that you can stay in the system and then you can have much more autonomy.
I also I think that's very much true. And the other thing, I do a lot of interdisciplinary research and a lot of science community, a lot of other things. I think I can do that to some extent because the lab is running well, and because we're publishing, and because we're bringing in money. So there is always a fear of spreading yourself too thin, and then and losing credibility because you're not publishing, you're not doing the classical things that you're supposed to be doing. So when you recruit students, if you see a student or a postdoc who's like you, who's like, well, you know, is that what you're looking for? Or do you say, oh my God, you know, another me, you know, so how do you feel about that?
I would say we try to keep that one neutral because we think that great teams are made up of people who have all of these different perspectives and different ways of seeing the world and different ways of working. And that if we only try to recruit a team of people who are like me, then that's like just a real loss, both because as a team, we're not going to be as effective. And also because we're just going to miss out on like 90% of the really talented, driven, motivated people out there. So we definitely have things that we think about when we're recruiting. The kind of tensions we've faced as we've tried to get better as a group at articulating what are our values, because then that helps us make more equitable decisions about who we want to recruit to our lab. That in the absence of articulating those values, you're just saying, well, do we like this person or not? Which then is rife with implicit biases. It's rife with how people navigate hidden curriculum. It's just not ideal. But then as we articulate, well, here's the things we value. Here's the type of people we want to recruit. We've had to be really careful not to then create that in a way that, exactly as you said, we're only recruiting one, you know, kind of type of people, but rather how do we do that in a way that we're intentionally recruiting, we're actually creating space to recruit people who want to value lots of different perspectives and want mm-hmm. to collaborate with people who are different than them and want to cultivate an inclusive environment and want to collaborate and want to innovate and want to cross disciplinary boundaries. Those are some of the things we've been able to say, okay, well, here are some values that seem like things we can look for universally in people we're recruiting, but it doesn't limit us to one type of person. It actually creates space to be able to recruit a really diverse team.
Who's the we? Because I noticed when you said we used move to MRA, you always use the word we. Because I heard you give a podcast where you said that you were getting several offers from different places, and you said we hadn't decided. Who moved with you?
Quite a lot of the group members did, in fact. It was a little bit tougher structurally for the undergraduate students to move, right? Because it's changing their enrollment. Although actually one of our undergraduate students then was able to come and do a summer with us at Emory, which was really, really fun. But it truly was a group decision. And this is maybe one of the things that I do differently from a lot of, I definitely do this differently from what the traditional academic system dictates, but it's one of the really, really important things to me is that everyone in my group, we are colleagues and we are equals. We have different responsibilities. You know, I certainly then do have this sort of evaluative role. I'm also, you know, very aware that there is a power structure in academia. I feel like I spend so much of my energy just trying to rip down that power structure because I despise it and I wish I didn't, you know, exist in that power structure. I wish we truly were equals in the academic system, but at least as much as possible, when we all walk into a meeting together, when we all walk into our lab, I want as much as possible to create a situation where we truly are all equal. And so when we were thinking about moving, the group all weighed in on that. They got to take a look at what the options were, and we had tons of anonymous opinion polls and votes. And, you know, I gave the decision to the group, and then at the end of the day, they gave it back to me. They said, well, we're in grad school for 4 years or postdocs for a few years, and you and your family are going to live with this decision for, you know, a lot more years than that. You're moving forever, you know, for a lot of your career. And so you should do what you think is best for you. But in fact, we all arrived at the same decision because they all thought about the decision in those terms. They said, well, okay, maybe this option would have been more fun for us for a couple of years, but really this option is the thing that is in the best interest of our lab for the long term. And that was exactly what I had seen too. And so we made the decision together. It was a lot of fun.
So I heard that you said that there are traditional and non-traditional way to do some stuff. Do you have advice for students to find a mentor? Is there an untraditional way to do that? Or
I don't know if there's an untraditional way to do that. Well, actually, I will say I found my mentors or kind of joined my PhD lab and joined my postdoc lab, I will say, in probably untraditional ways. And that was through networking. And I think one thing that is really powerful now that didn't even exist then was social media, and mm-hmm. that things like Twitter can be a powerful way to network with people in advance of trying to get a position in their lab. And it's helpful because the interviewing goes both ways. You're trying to get to know them and create a positive impression with them, but you're also looking at who they are in that space and looking at what's happening in their lab and how people interact with each other, and able to think about whether it's a place that you are going to be happy and successful as well. So I think that can be powerful. And mm-hmm. you know, something that I always recommend when you're thinking about a lab is absolutely talk to current group members. And if possible, talk to former group members and ask really, really specific questions. You know, rather than asking, oh, well, you know, are they flexible about work hours, or are they a good person to work for? Ask things like, how do they react when you have a failed experiment? What is their policy about taking time out in the afternoon to go to a mental health care appointment? Or what did they do when someone had, when you had a personal family emergency? Mm-hmm. I think those sorts of questions really get at whether it's a place that's going to be a supportive place.
So we found a quote from you. You said, I'm convinced that the value of my life will not be measured in awards or accomplishments, and presumably publications as well, right?
Yeah.
Something that I've heard you speak about a lot is the fear of failure, and how we need to acknowledge more the fear of failure and find ways to incorporate that into our training and learning. Why is that so important for a scientist? And more importantly, how can we prepare students for that?
Well, why it's important for us as scientists is because we fail a lot, right? I mean, maybe other people don't experience this, but I feel like 95% of what I did in grad school failed. And so if we're in this job where 95% of what we're going to do is fail, then we probably ought to really think about how to get good at failing, or how to at least not fear it. And so this is actually the how do we teach this to people is why we started FlameNet, which is this now big nationwide research collaborative network that's really devoted to that question. And it's complicated. And so we support a ton of people doing research into how do students even think about failure? How does that then intersect with their science identity or their sense of belonging and their retention in STEM? And then how can we change what instructors are doing in the classroom or what mentors are doing in the lab? How can we come in and do that better in order to help students learn how to overcome fear of failure? But the thing that we've really, as we've thought through this more, one of the things that's come into focus is to really acknowledge that failure is unavoidable, but failure isn't like a good thing. When we say we need to embrace failure, it isn't like, oh, I'm going to go fail on purpose because failure is just so awesome and I want to experience it. Failure is bad. Like, failure stinks. It's painful. Every once in a while, I have a few of these, failure will push you down a path that ends up being even better. But most of the time, failure is just this speed bump or roadblock or whatever. It's a bad thing. But the key is that if we are afraid of failure, that leads us into doing things that actually make us more likely to fail. And so if we can confront that fear of failure and overcome that fear of failure, or at least develop comfort with the fear of failure, coexist with it, then that leads us into a set of actions or behaviors or ways of thinking that makes us actually be more likely to be successful. And so that's the real goal, is not to like fail more often, but to develop a comfort with failure so that we make choices that actually make us less likely to fail.
2 years ago, just before the pandemic, we had our Christmas party in the department, and every team had to prepare a poster. And so I said to my team, why don't we prepare a poster with all the failures of the year, celebration of failure. So we put up on this big poster that we stuck on the door, we put up all the gels that didn't work and the rejection from grants and the rejection from editors, and just like everything we could find linked to failure. That was pre-COVID.
I love that so much. That is so good.
When then success appear, sometimes we are like almost not able to enjoy it or sometimes not able to recognize it. So it drives me to the imposter syndrome idea. Maybe you can help us also to dig into this topic, but it's a phenomenon that question our value as a scientist, as a human being. And so how can we recognize it? Because sometimes it's not easy to see that we are suffering from this. And how can we fight it?
Well, one thing I feel strongly about on imposter syndrome, and I feel like I always have to preface anything I say about imposter syndrome with this, is that the sense of imposter syndrome that's probably inherent to all of us or to most people, and that's something that we can work to fight. But there's also a heck of a lot of imposter syndrome that is created because we work in places that are still rife with biases, with sexism or racism, you know, which then leads to tokenism, and that all of those things, all of those injustices fuel a lot of what we call imposter syndrome. But then so much of the content on imposter syndrome is like, here's how to do the work within yourself. But we so rarely look out and say, no, we need to fix the system as well that's driving this. So I always want to acknowledge that before we dive in, that a lot of them, you know, we have to keep fixing the system. And a really good, you know, for anyone who's listening, who wants to be part of doing this, we all have the potential that anytime, you know, just a really simple little thing, anytime you're in a conversation and you hear someone start to say the words, well, so-and-so person only got that award / fellowship / whatever, because they are a fill in the blank, to be an ally in that moment and say, wait, no, I think what you meant to say is they got that award because they're amazing at what they do and they've contributed a ton. Because it's things like that. It's the culture where, I don't know, we have a culture where people feel comfortable saying those things because they do say them. And that's so unacceptable. And that drives then a lot of imposter syndrome, right? How are you going to not feel imposter syndrome when you've heard those words? And so that's one of the things we really need to work on. And there's tons of forms of that, you know, just not seeing representation, right? So in the United States, we do not have the same racial and ethnic representation among faculty that we do among students. And then that's not even representative of the general population of our country. And so if you're a graduate student and you don't see any faculty members who look like you, then that's going to drive a lot of imposter syndrome. And that's not, you know, something we should be teaching people how to fix within themselves. It's like, no, we need to fix the system that is broken, that is making that be that way. And so I always have to say that. And so for all of us, we can be working to fix the system, and the more power we have. So Jonathan, people in our positions, and then people who have even more power than us, you know, the more power we have, the more responsibility we have to be doing that. At the same time, yeah, there's certainly things we can do. And a lot of the advice I give on this is about just recognizing, it's actually really similar to cognitive behavioral therapy, recognizing those false imposter syndrome thoughts that you have, those cognitive distortions you have of, say, comparing your CV to someone else's and minimizing the importance of areas where you're strong, and maximizing the areas of the importance of the areas where you're weak or where you're not as good as someone else. And if you can start to recognize those cognitive distortions, then you can start to correct them and say, oh, wait, no, I'm minimizing the importance of this area or maximizing the importance of this other area rather than viewing these in their context. Or I'm comparing my first draft to someone else's final product. And you know, yes, as a first year grad student, I don't know how to work the HPLC as well as that person, but that doesn't mean I'm bad at chemistry. That just means they've been here for 3 years longer than I have, and I'll get there too. So I think it's recognizing those ways that we distort reality in order to drive that imposter syndrome narrative, and then learning to counter those. And if possible, having people around us, having friends where we help each other recognize and counter those as well.
Great. There is also one other thing that we've seen that you have your thought on is about all the process of decision making and coping, as you have written, coping with uncertainty. Because I think most of the scientists have all at one time of their career this problem of coping with this. Is it, how what would you tell to our listeners that are now dealing with this kind of
uncertainty problem or decision-making problem?
I think two things that have helped me a lot are, with the uncertainty, trying to think about what can I control and what can't I control? Because really, even when we don't feel uncertainty, or even, you know, we're in a pandemic right now, obviously, right? So there's a ton of uncertainty. But it isn't that there wasn't uncertainty before the pandemic. We just didn't think about it as much, right? You know, I left for work in the morning and I felt certain that I would have a home to come back to. But that was a false sense of security, right? Because someone might have driven down my street during the middle of the afternoon, run into a power line, knocked it over onto my home, and, you know, then I would not have had a home to come home to. Yeah. And that was something that could have happened, right? But I didn't have a sense of uncertainty because it wasn't so right in front of me. And so the more we can, and I couldn't have controlled it anyways. I'd have said, well, unless I'm going to sit in my front yard and try and stop a car that would do that, I can't control it. I can just say, well, yes, that might happen. And that's why I have homeowner's insurance or whatever. And I think the equivalent right now is saying, well, what things, there's a lot of uncertainty. What things can I control and what things can't I control? And control the things we can, but then try to, you know, maybe plan for the things we can't control, but not get stuck in a rut ruminating on them. So like, what can I control? Well, I can control the fact that I'm working from home today. I can control the fact that, you know, Omicron is spiking in the United States. So we moved our group meetings to virtual for today and tomorrow. Those are things we can control. Can I control whether there's going to be another variant that comes after this one? No, I absolutely cannot. Mm. I can say, well, okay, I'm going to think about what that might mean for my lab. I'm going to think about what we might do if that happens and have some sort of a plan. But if I get stuck ruminating over, well, what will life look like in March or April? That's just going to cause a lot of stress that's unnecessary and keep me from being able to show up and be my best for the people in my group right now.
Yeah. And if I can add it to it, because I resonate with what you say, because sometimes I feel that my brain is a bit stupid and is stuck into one thing that I cannot control because I want those things to be too perfect. But we had our first guest of the season one that said, enough is good enough. So now I'm trying to improve, but it feels like you're putting so much energy sometimes in a task that is not going to move anything. So you just, for what I hear, yeah, you just try to recognize it and say, okay, it's okay, move on, do something else. That
yeah.
One thing we can't control is that is that we're going to take a break.
Good, that works.
We're just going to take a break, have a stretch, and then we'll be back after the break. We're going to talk less about the lab and a little bit more about you.
Hey folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at Lonely Pipette, and please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from the Lonely Pipette.
Welcome back to the part two of this episode with Jen that is with us today. It's a pleasure. We spend almost 1 hour. I don't know if it will be 1 hour until now, but it's almost 1 hour we are recording this episode. We could go forever, but we need to move to the next topic. So for the second part, we will just jump more into who is Jen Hemstra. Is there one thing that you cannot miss in the morning?
Coffee. You know, I've actually accidentally done the experiment to realize it's partly psychological and partly physical, but it just is that thing that kind of wakes me up. And I love sitting on the couch and sipping my coffee and going through my emails or starting to work. But I went recently on a little trip with my two kids for an outdoor climbing competition. And we bought a bunch of groceries to take for our trip because we had a little kitchen. On the first day, we're climbing. And I'm thinking, gosh, I've got kind of a headache. You know, I woke up, had my coffee. Everything was great. You probably know where this is going. thinking, wow, I'm feeling kind of tired. It's like, I must just be relaxing or it's sunny out or whatever. And then we got back and I fell into bed and took a 2-hour nap, which I almost never do. And then the next day again, you know, we got up and got ready and everything as usual. And we're driving home and I'm thinking, gosh, I've got kind of this headache. And it dawned on me and we're parked because we took a little hike. And I walk to the back of the car, open up the hatchback, pull out the bag of coffee and look, and it is decaffeinated that I accidentally bought because I was so intent. I was like, it's October. I'm going to get pumpkin spice coffee because that's, you know, the thing we do in October. And I had accidentally bought decaf. So the first thing of the morning, I've done the control experiment, the double blind placebo, the initial sitting on the couch, drinking the coffee and thinking, I feel so awake now. That is 100% placebo related to caffeine, but then I will feel it later if I don't have
so, actually, I'm going to ask the question we don't normally ask, which, what's your wind down routine? Like what happens at the end of the day?
Because are you asking that because you realize I clearly need one?
there must be something, yeah.
I do have, so I on my way home from work, this is a hard thing during the pandemic, is that for me, my drive home from work, it's not particularly long, it's about 15 minutes, but that's my time to decompress, you know, put everything in order from the day. Like, what did I get done? What did I not? When's that stuff going to happen now? What did I do well? What did I mess up? What did I learn from that? How am I going to do better next time? And then I get home and I might answer a few emails or things like that, or talk to my spouse about work because we work in the same place. But for the most part, I'm not trying to do anything anymore. You know, the to-do list is shut off till tomorrow unless there's a really big deadline. And then, yeah, we have a meal with our family, and then either with our kids or just my spouse and I will watch a little bit of TV. And then the thing that, and all of that is kind of a wind down, but actually my secret self-care, my secret favorite self-care thing is to, after everyone has gone to bed, to sit on the couch by myself in the dark with a drink and just enjoy the silence. And I need that.
How long is that?
Yeah, what's the minimum time you need?
Depends on how much the day has wound me up, how much time I need to wind down, or depending on how tired I am or how late it is.
That's great. But, so that's just you in the dark.
Yeah. If I let myself, I could sit there for hours and just enjoy. Mm-hmm. But then I start thinking, oh, I'm going to regret this tomorrow. I really need to be responsible and go to bed now. Usually, you know, 15, 20 minutes or so.
Wow, that's great. Mm. So in the last couple of years, what's a belief or a behavior or a habit that's changed your life?
I'll actually go with two things. And I'll say they're super boring little things. And this, I tell my lab members this, that the simultaneously most encouraging and depressing thing of midlife, you know, being in my 40s, is realizing that so much of success and happiness and fulfillment comes down to habits. It's like, It's depressing because you're like, well, wait, that's like the secret of life, is just all of these little tiny boring things that we do every single day. For real, that's it.
But then, you can do something about it.
Exactly. That's what's so encouraging about it. It's like, oh, but then we control a lot of that. And obviously, you know, that's not the whole secret to everything. But two things that have been really big for me are that I gave myself a personal retreat a few years back to think about my goals and where I wanted to be and where I was and where I was going. And one of the activities I did for myself during that was I set all of these goals and where I want to be in 5-10 years. And then the last one, inspired by something one of my friends and mentors had said to me, was, well, who do I have to become in order to be able to do these things? And I realized that there were four areas where I needed to consistently challenge myself to grow in certain ways and to show up and be in certain ways in every interaction that I have. And so I put like two words to each of those. And then there's a whole lot else that's behind it and sentences and questions and things. But then every morning, as I'm kind of finishing my meditation time, I think through those four things and then they stick with me sort of throughout the day. So that's one really intentional thing. And then my morning exercise, unless it's a really hard workout, sometimes it's just a brisk walk, sometimes it's a run. But if I'm running or walking, I brief myself on my day. So I'm not important enough to have like a chief of staff, you know, like presidents and stuff have. You know, the presidents have these chief of staff who come in the morning and brief them and say, okay, your 9 a.m. meeting is this, and you need to know this for it. And your 11 a.m. is this, and you need to be ready to do this. And then we're going to there, and you need to do that. And so I'm not important enough to have someone who does that for me, obviously. So I just do it for myself. And so as I'm out working out or walking, I'm thinking through, okay, my 10 a.m. is this meeting, and what do I need to know for that meeting? And what is there anything I need to think about in advance that I need to decide for that meeting? And then, okay, at, you know, 11 a.m., I'm going to do the Lonely Pipette podcast. And so I need to think about this and just have fun and be yourself and be prepared for that. And then, okay, after that, I'm going to go to my subgroup. And so, oh yeah, I need to look through all the slides in advance. And here's how I need to be ready to show up to support everyone in that subgroup, especially right now during COVID. And so I just brief myself through my day in the morning, and it just helps me feel ready. And often it helps me think through something really important that I need to think about in a meeting. And that probably helps me to not have to worry about thinking about it in all of the days that led up to that.
Would you mind sharing what the four words are?
Yeah. Well, actually, okay. So I won't share all of them, but I'll share two of them with you. Two of them are go last and trust big. And so go last, that's as a leader, right? My job is to put myself last in line and not to like not do self-care. In fact, self-care is so important. Self-care is critical, is the foundation that allows me to then show up in this way. But that if I do all of my self-care, like that morning walk and my evening on the couch, then I can, every meeting I come into or every interaction I come into, the question behind that is, can I make someone else's day better? Or can I show support for someone? Or can I improve academic culture? How can I do something positive in this space? You know, maybe there are a few times that I don't show up and do that, but for the most part, especially like with my lab, you know, walking into a subgroup, how can I show up as a supportive mentor who's going to help each person be their best, who's going to encourage people when they need it, who's going to help each person believe in what's capable, who's going to give solid, sound, scientific advice. So that's a big one for me. And then the trust big is just, am I not doing something because I'm afraid I'll fail? Am I making decisions out of fear rather, you know, because often I'll make a decision that's really out of fear, but I'll tell myself that I'm doing it because it's time management.
But you're so successful and so articulate. What's your fears?
Oh my gosh, all of them. I'm halfway through writing a book and I'm still afraid of writing a book. So there you go.
But you don't tell me you're still afraid of podcasts.
No. Well, okay. I mean, it still makes me a little nervous, right? Because you want to, I know that I do best when I don't know the questions in advance, but then that's also a little bit scary.
Outside of science, do you have an individual, a celebrity, or anyone that inspire you for your life and your work, but outside of science?
Oh, I have a lot of those. Some of them are just, they're not celebrities. They're just normal people who are friends who inspire me as mentors. Sure. But one person who is, I think is a celebrity in my area or area of hobby is Lynn Hill. And so Lynn Hill is a rock climber. She is still awesome now, but really the peak of her athletic career was, you know, when I was getting into rock climbing. And then for many years after that, you know, now she's this amazing coach and mentor and still really, I mean, better climbing. She can climb stuff that 99% of people will never be able to do.
So what inspires you that her technical skills or something else?
So yeah, sorry, I just went on and on about who Lynn Hill is. But what inspires me, and I probably felt this when I was getting into rock climbing, was also the time that I was getting into science. And science, you know, was and still is, but definitely in the 90s, was a very male-dominated field. And she was in rock climbing in this very, very male-dominated environment. And she showed up and was unapologetically, uncompromisingly herself, but still found a way to integrate into that culture and into that activity and just absolutely dominate at it. And so one of the things that she did that is so notable is that she was the first person to free climb the nose on El Capitan. So it's not free soloing. It's where you still have rope, but you're only using your hands to do the climbing. She was the first person, you know, male or female, to free climb it. And this was this, you know, holy grail, this big, big, big goal that climbers had always thought was impossible. And then when she came down, or at the very end of it, what she said is, "It goes, boys." And I thought that was so, for a teenage girl in going into a male dominated field, I was just like, oh, that is really awesome. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this word, you'll edit it out, but that is so badass. Oh my gosh, I love it. And I want that energy. But she was just herself. She didn't feel like she had to, you know, she didn't try to act like all of the people around her. She was just her and was so amazing. And I thought that that's how I want to be.
So can you think of an achievement where you got that, where you were, that you're particularly proud of because you got that that energy of just being yourself?
I don't know if it's an achievement, but really just, I feel like going to work every day. I like to think that I don't do this faculty job like a lot of people do, that I'm trying to just be me. I certainly learn a lot from people around me and I share ideas and I get inspired from what other people are doing, but that I show up every day and think, how do I want to be as a leader? How do I want to run a lab? How do I want to do research? And I don't feel the pressure to try to do that the way that it's always been done. In fact, I purposely want to do it differently than the way it's always been done. But that's part of my personality as well. I can take you to that exact spot in my personality inventory and be like, yeah, that number right there. That's, I will do things differently to a fault. Like I will do it differently, even if it's not better, just because I want to be different.
So you're doing all these things. You're running the lab and you're doing all this mentoring and all these 15 minutes. And then we hear the rocks, climbing, the golf, and you have
the book.
You have two kids. And how does this all work? Like you have the same 24 hours as the rest of us, right? How are you balancing it? How are you getting balance?
Well, I'll say, I think balance doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Yeah. Nalini Nadkarni, who was one of my colleagues at University of Utah, she said, there's no such thing as balance or trying to find balance. Just try to avoid imbalance for too long. I was like, that's right. Okay. It's like, if you've ever been on one of those like exercise contraptions, it's like a board with like half of the Bosu ball underneath, right? And you're like, trying to balance and you never hit perfect balance. Or if you do, you flinch and then you're like, you know, trying to adjust. But rather it's just this constant series of negotiating. Oh, this will be an intense week because I have a grant deadline. So maybe I'll work some late nights this week, but then I'm going to be intentional in saying no to other things so that I can carve out the time I need to be with my family. You know, and next week then I'm not going to feel bad at all that I got into work at 10 a.m. on Tuesday or something like that. So I think it's navigating that. I think every person finds their way that they manage their time. For me, it's probably two things that are deeply embedded in my personality. One is what I talked about earlier, that I am that person who is hyper-focused on efficiency, that I can structure my day around how do I be as efficient as possible. It's like when I was a graduate student, I always said, never not be doing something, right? If I was running a TLC plate, which takes about a minute and a half, I think, oh, well, I can wash 3 round bottom flasks in that time and then I don't have to do dishes later. But I think for some people, if you're not wired that way, I think that trying to think that way is so exhausting, it's counterproductive. But because that just, for me, it's a fun game. It's like playing Sudoku. It's like my version of Sudoku of like, okay, what is the way that I can arrange all of these tasks to fit them into it? It isn't about saving the 5 minutes. It's about the challenge of, can I problem solve? It's really a problem solving challenge. And the other thing is I've learned to let go of perfection. We had a kid before I even started my faculty career, which is something that was not typical at the time. So I just never had that option to say, I'm just going to work as many hours as I want, that, you know, some people might have. And it just forced me to say, oh yes, no, well, it's 5 o'clock. I've got to pick up my kid from daycare. So this manuscript is as good as it's going to get. Like it's good enough. And I'm going to submit it or this grant. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to let go. I used to be a perfectionist. And this job has fundamentally kind of like rewired my personality to let go of that perfectionism. But then if I can turn it into, oh, but I can get more done, then that's the little, you know, neurological, I'm sure, chemical reward for myself there.
Could you identify an apparent failure which set you up for later success?
Oh, yes. I almost didn't get tenure. And that was the worst failure. That day was the worst failure I've ever felt. It was actually the worst day of my life because, and I've had some bad days, you know, losing my dad, losing my best friend. But that was the worst day of my life because I felt like I had messed up. It was my fault. And now I had wrecked things for my lab, for my family, for all the people I care about the most in the world. And it was my fault. And having to sit in that was really, really hard. When I initially found out, I thought, okay, well, maybe I'm going to have to find a new job and or do something differently. But it was actually my group. This fundamentally changed the way we do things in our lab because I was already someone who thought, okay, we're a team. We're all in it together. Let's try to be as egalitarian as possible, you know, within the structure of academia. But then when I went and told my group, you know, I called my husband and then I went and told my group and people had some choice words, but then they said, okay, we are all in this together. You know, we know that we have this great research program and you're going to get tenure somewhere, whether it's here or somewhere else, because it just wasn't clear whether or not it was not a great vote. So it wasn't clear whether it would work out or not. And they said, as long as we get to keep doing this research and we get to keep staying together as our lab, we'll just go wherever you go. And I was like, all righty, that's what we're doing. Yes. And it was one of the most humbling moments of my life because just to have a group of people who owed me nothing, you know, show up and show that kind of support and loyalty to our team. I said, okay, well, yeah, that's what we're going to do. But then, yeah, coming out of that, there would be no me on Twitter. I wouldn't be here doing the podcast. I wouldn't be doing most of the things I'm doing, actually. That was one of those experiences where because I had an amazing support system through that, mm-hmm. I really had a lot of privilege of support. It was that slingshot. It stretched me and stretched me. And because I was able to come out of that successfully, it really just made me fearless. It was like, well, I've been through that. Mm-hmm. So what do I have to be afraid of? You know, I'm wildly open to feedback. Nothing offends me. What worse failure could I possibly have professionally?
Thanks for sharing that, because I think people need to hear that. And thanks for opening up to the vulnerability of that. So we have a question. We're going to start to wrap up. What advice would you give to yourself if you met yourself 20 years ago?
It'd be to realize that by the time I'm reflecting on the value of my own life, all of the people who are speaking into it now, their expectations or opinions about what I should do or what I need to achieve or what I need to prioritize, most of those voices won't be there when I'm reflecting on what I've done. It will be me and what I value, and that I will be comparing what I've done to my own expectations and what I hope to achieve. And so I should be making decisions in that way, to not try to make your decisions based on other people's expectations.
Wow. Yeah, that's super great. Thanks so much for opening up like this with us and sharing all those nice words and thoughts that you have. So we need to finally end the podcast now, but we need two other questions. So see you next week for second part two. No, we need two other things from you. Is where can people find out more about you?
So you can find out about our lab at heemstralab.com. And actually from there are links to all of our social media accounts, but our lab account is at Heemstra Lab, and I'm at Jen Heemstra.
On Twitter. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Like, the floor is yours to close the podcast.
I will just say that if your goal was to get me to talk about things I don't normally talk about on podcasts, you have been wildly successful. So congratulations.
Yes.
Cheers. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
You're the first time we I know you work on nucleic acids, but you're first time we stepped beyond our comfort zone in biology. And no, thank you very much for coming.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at The Lonely Pipette.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences, or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at Lonely Pipette, and please share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to the Lonely Pipette mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!
Hey guys, one last thing to finish up. If you like the soundtrack of the show, you might want to know who is the artist behind it. The song is called Lovely Swindler by Amaria, a talented French artist who composes electro swing. We are really grateful for allowing us to use it, and if you like it too, the best thing to do is to share it. Thanks again, and see you soon.